Hello and welcome to this conference. My name is Jai Bristow and I'm one of your hosts. And today I am so happy to be welcoming back the marvelous Mel Cassidy. Welcome, Mel.
Thank you, Jai.
So Mel is a relationship coach and creator of the Monogamy Detox course, and they are dedicated to creating somatically integrated and trauma-sensitive spaces where all can flourish. And today we're going to be talking about safety and particularly orienting to safety in non-monogamy. So Mel, do you want to kick us off by defining what's the word or the term safety means for you in this context?
Thank you. What a great question. I think there's many different ways we can define safety, but in this context, I'm thinking of safety as what is our nervous system experiencing? Right? Our nervous system has this wonderful ability to, you know, it's obsessed. It's constantly looking to assess, am I safe or am I not? And it's keeping us safe. And what that means is that we are free from threat. And when we are free from threat or even perceived threat, there's a calm and a grounding and an equipoise that happens in our nervous system. Our nervous system can be resilient and present, and we can show up in the here and now. So when I think of safety, I think of it as an inner experience where I'm able to be present to the here and now. And when I have a lack of safety, then I may struggle to be present to what is here and now. I may be struggle to be present with myself. I might struggle to be present with my partners. I might struggle to be present with what's happening in the world around me. So sometimes we can look at this definition in terms of, okay, what happens when that safety is absent? So I think it really boils down to an inner experience where there is an absence of threat, an absence of fear, or at least an absence of imminent fear and threat, and that we're able to be present.
That's a beautiful definition. And I really appreciate how you talk about, you know, it's very much an inner experience, right? And I appreciate how your definition takes into account like physical safety, emotional safety, psychological safety, you know, it takes it all into account if we bring it back to the nervous system. And so I'm curious, like when it comes to open relationships, why is there so much fear and apprehension and perhaps, you know, that feeling that it's not safe, even when it's something that people know that they want or that people, you know, at least want to try and explore, but feel like they can't for whatever reason?
So there's a couple of different elements to this. So one, which I think we've talked about in the past, is, you know, it's unfamiliar territory, right? And anytime we walk into unfamiliar territory, our nervous system goes, well, we don't know what to expect. And so that feels, the unfamiliarity of it feels unsafe. But there's actually something else that's happening. So, you know, normally, the way our nervous system processes experiences, when we have a novel experience, whether that's positive, negative, disruptive, whatever it is, it's a novel experience, and our nervous system uses all the information it has to determine, is this safe or not? And if the nervous system goes, we're safe, this is cool, then we're fine. If the nervous system goes, this doesn't feel safe, then it's going to go into, okay, how do I want to respond to that? Do I want to fight this perceived threat? Do I want to run away? Do I want to roll over? Do I want to appease this person? Do I need to reach out and ask for help? Right? We have all these wonderful strategies in our nervous system. But that's if we get to the point of determining that we are not safe. And I think when it comes to open relationships or any kind of queering of monogamy, the nervous system often doesn't have enough information to determine whether we are safe or not. And so in somatic experiencing, this is called a disrupted orienting response. You know, we're not even able to get to that point of knowing whether we're safe or not. And then there's a whole bunch of stuff that happens to the nervous system, right? Where, you know, we're stuck in this state of hypervigilance. And that's a lot of energy going into the nervous system, trying to figure out, am I safe or not? You know, the image it brings up for me is like a small animal just running around in panic. And in that state of panic, we're not present to the here and now. We lose connection to the people around us. We lose connection to our partners. And it becomes this kind of like catch 22, because you lose connection to the things that are actually going to give you the information about whether you're safe or not. And you know, this isn't always the experience when people are exploring open relationships, but it is something that can happen along the way.
And I think that's a really important, you know, distinction to make, is that not everyone will experience this, but many people will, simply because a lot of the time it's unfamiliar, right? So what does happen when people ignore this sense of like, something's not right, or I'm on high alert, and, you know, are going in maybe into trauma responses, the fight, flight, freeze, fawn that you talked about? And then sometimes even try and override their nervous system. I know that I've definitely done that in the past, that often also that belief that like, I should feel a certain way, or I shouldn't feel a certain way. And that kind of like, let me just get over this, and I can just rationally, I know that this is what I want, and this is, you know, and so let me try and use my rationale to override my emotions.
Well, I think you described one of the things that happens there, which is, you know, when we are overwhelmed by a situation, and when I say overwhelm, I mean, there's just so much going on, whether that is we're trying to read all the information around us to determine our safety, or we're exerting a lot of energy to push those signals away. All that energy becomes exhausting, right? That's a lot of energy to be putting out. And I hear this so often from people exploring non-monogamy, especially in the early days. They're like, wow, this is exhausting. This is a lot of work. And I'm like, well, yeah, there's a lot of things going on. You're tracking a lot of different relationships now. And so in that state of exhaustion, what will happen is our nervous system, to keep us safe, to support us in an inner experience of safety, whether we are actually safe on the outside or not, it will disconnect from some of those pieces of information. So we might call that dissociation. Mm-hmm. And I think I have a slightly different take on dissociation from what is sort of like classically looked at. I think it's not just we dissociate from the here and now, we dissociate from receiving all that information because it's just too much, right? We just pull that shutdown switch. It's also we retreat into the parts of ourselves that we feel more safe and confident in. So what you were just describing sounds like you retreat back into your intellect. And I think that's a very common place for us to retreat to. And in non-monogamy as well, you know, what do we have to support us in knowing whether we are safe or not? We have lots of intellectual material, right? There's an increasing amount of literature, which is great. I love that there's so much more literature now than there was even 5 years ago. It's phenomenal. But we lean in on the literature to help us understand our experience. We lean into the discussions to help us understand what other people are going through. And that is all very much an intellectual experience, right? It's not an embodied experience. So we retreat into the intellect to try and understand the experience that we're having. And that's, you know, that is totally fair. That's a place to go. But there's a cost to that, because if you retreat into the intellect and you're like, oh, it's safe here, it doesn't feel safe when I go into my body, it doesn't feel safe when I go into my emotions, it doesn't feel safe when I go into my creativity, I'm just going to like stay up here in my head, then we are dissociating from the here and now still. Mm. Right? Likewise, we might not just dissociate into our intellect, we might say dissociate into our body. And so what that could look like is the need, that urge to be physically exerting a lot. So for some people, that could look like they start going to the gym all the time, or they go out dancing. For some people, that also means they need to shut down their mind. So they might turn to mind-altering substances. They might turn to alcohol. They might turn to other things that help their mind shut down or like stop that the cycles turning, the wheels turning in the brain. Likewise, we can also, I think, you know, retreat into our heart and retreat into our emotions. You know, for some people, being connected to our emotions and then disconnecting from our head, disconnecting from our body is what feels more safe to go to. And so in that space, you know, we're really focusing on the emotions so that we can better understand them. But what that might look like on the outside is someone who is running a roller coaster of emotions and maybe having what seems like, you know, what may have in a past time being called histrionic reactions, but I would call that, you know, an expression of emotions that is very, very intense because there's so much energy going on there. That might also look like someone maybe not thinking through what they're doing because they're not connected to their intellect and they're just going on impulse, right? That emotional impulse of like, this feels right. I'm going to connect with this person in this way. And maybe they don't make the best choices, or maybe they forget about relationship agreements that they'd had. And then I think there's also a way that we can dissociate into our eroticism. You know, I call this our spirit, but, you know, it's where our eroticism lives. It's where our spirituality lives. It's where our creativity lives. And that can look like really pursuing hedonism in a disembodied way, which is not something I see very commonly, but I think it is something that happens. I know that I in my own experience have touched and tapped into that. And, you know, there's a certain kind of intoxication that can come in there. And that intoxication just, you know, helps you forget about everything else that's going on. So, you know, when we are overriding those signals and whether we are retreating away or whether we are sort of diving in deeper into something to tackle it head on, you know, we are disconnecting from parts of ourselves. And in that disconnection, we're losing the ability to be present.
Yeah.
And then that has roll-on consequences, right? And especially if you're looking at, and I mean, this is true for any kind of relationship, but I think especially in non-monogamy, when you're looking at engaging with multiple people and you have complex networks of relationships, there is an impact not just on your own relationships, but there is potentially an impact on all the people you're relating with and maybe the people they're relating with and maybe the people that those people are relating with, right? There are ripple effects. And so I this can lead to all sorts of complexity. And so then, you know, one person struggling can lead to a roll-on effect that creates, I want to call it a vortex of chaos for everybody. And then you suddenly have not just one person whose nervous system is disrupted and dysregulated, but perhaps a whole collection of people whose nervous system is disrupted and dysregulated.
It's interesting. What you call the vortex of chaos, I call the negative ripple effect, which I think I've talked about previously. But the idea how, you know, when one person is having an unhealthy relationship, for example, or, you know, has toxic behaviors or is putting up with someone else's toxic behaviors or something like that, how it doesn't just impact that one relationship, right? It will impact how the person is feeling. It will impact their relationships with everyone else. Again, relationship in the broad sense of the word. This isn't just in non-monogamy, but I think it can be heightened in non-monogamy when there's multiple partners, but it can definitely exist in all types of relationships. You know, it might then have an impact on when they're talking to their friend, and then it might have an impact on that friend's relationship with their mother who they're living with, or then, you know, whatever it is. So I think that, you know, you're really pointing to why it's important to be regulated, right? And I really appreciate how you've brought in all these very like concrete examples of ways people can dissociate, disconnect, as you were saying. And to me, what you're describing sounds like trauma responses, essentially, right?
Yeah. And I should say as well, like, you know, part of that vortex that of chaos that comes up is we're so used to relying on the support of other people to help us regulate our nervous system. And that is healthy, right? That is how human beings have evolved. Our nervous systems co-regulate with other nervous system, whether those are humans or animals, you know, and we also co-dysregulate. Mm-hmm. So if you are in a situation where your nervous system is dysregulated, and all the people who are proximal to you have a nervous system that is dysregulated, who's helping to regulate the nervous systems, right? How are you accessing that co-regulation space in a regulated way rather than a dysregulated way? And I think there is a risk sometimes in non-monogamy that because of all the stigma that people can face, people can become very insular in their little polycules and anarchules, as I call them, and maybe not have people outside of that that they can connect with to help regulate their nervous systems.
Yeah, that makes a lot of sense. And I'm really glad you brought that piece in because I think it's really important. I'm curious, Mel, because, you know, you're really, you know, showing that, okay, trauma responses, nothing wrong with trauma responses. They are very human and natural reaction, right? So this is not to demonize anyone who has had any of the reactions that you've just listed or others. Like I said myself, I could recognize myself in actually quite a few of the ones you listed, you know, my going reverting to intellect is just one of them. And at the same time, they are trauma responses. They're not particularly healthy. They're not conducive to healthy relationships with oneself, with other people. They can have a negative ripple effect on other relationships. So absolutely not demonizing. And at the same time, what is the alternative?
Yeah. So we want to recognize these trauma responses as strategies to keep us safe, right? And I think holding that compassion is really important. Very often in relationships, when we see or experience a partner retreating away from us, you know, that tends to be a trigger for us. And then we go into a trauma response, and then it becomes this little cascade of trauma responses. Been there, done that, got the t-shirt 1,000 times over. But, you know, if we can access other resourcing, so by resourcing, I mean reaching outside of our relationships for support. Maybe that's to a counselor or a therapist or a coach or a somatic experiencing practitioner or whatever it is that supports you and resources you, to then access a space of compassion. You know, we want to have that compassion for others. We want to have that compassion for ourselves. And I think naming these things as trauma responses is really helpful. Right. And again, I love that you said, like, it's not to stigmatize anybody. These are human responses. If we're not responding in this way ever, then, you know, we either have the most regulated nervous system in the world or something else might be going on. But, you know, we want to hold compassion for the trauma responses. And then we want to look at, okay, how do we actually bring all these different parts of ourselves back into connection, right? Because the healing of trauma is the journey of coming back into being present to what is here and now. And if I've experienced the here and now as being overwhelming or scary or just too much for me to ascertain whether I'm safe or not, then I need the support to be able to better engage in that. And that could look like all sorts of things. That could look like bringing in intellectual information. You know, when in my monogamy detox course, I talk with folks about, okay, who are your positive role models for the kinds of relationships you want to have? We struggle with that in our society. You know, there's not many rom-coms that include non-monogamous storylines in a positive light, right? And we're lucky that there are an increasing number of examples in the media, in real life and fictional. But even so, they're, you know, it's limited. It's not quote unquote perfect. But we want to look at those role models. So that can be something that helps. But I think also, you know, going into understanding what is it that your nervous system is picking up on? And can you work with, and in somatic experiencing, we talk about, you know, what is the sensation of something? What image does it bring up? What's the, you know, the action or the impulse that you feel around that? What story do you hold around it? What's the emotional impact of that experience or sensation? And I think bringing in all those tools so that we can better understand what is it that is either overwhelming to us or that is disrupting our ability to engage. And sometimes what's disrupting our ability to engage is just perspective. And we just need the reassurance and we need the role modeling, or we need the information. We need to hear that what we're doing is possible. We need to know that what we're doing is not going to, you know, disrupt everything in our life, or that if it does cause disruption, that we're going to be okay through that, right? We're going to be supported. And I think in that regard, you know, having the support of peers is really, really valuable. And not everyone has the support of their family, right? And we experience this in queer communities too. We don't all have the support of our families. We may not always have the support of our friends in when we're exploring non-monogamy, especially if they are not familiar with it, or they're very, you know, committed to their monogamy. And so how do we resource ourselves with community? And then, you know, I think bringing in to, you know, how we combat all those other pieces of dissociation and disconnection is slowing down the experience, right? And I think having those questions that we can check in with ourselves, like, hey, right now I'm, you know, I'm engaging in something, but who am I doing this for? You know, am I being authentic to myself right now? Am I doing this because I'm wanting to run away or avoid something? Am I doing this because this is what the other person said they wanted? Right. And I love the wheel of consent work, because the, you know, wheel of consent, one of those questions is, who is this for? Right. And that's been great for me in checking my fawn response, my people pleasing and my self-sacrificing instincts that want to kick in all the time when I feel threatened. And so that asking that question of, okay, who is this for? And we're only really able to ask that question when we slow down. So slowing down is, I think, one of the most important things to do. And that is hard, because when we're faced with something that's uncomfortable and unfamiliar, our instinct is to rush through it. So slowing everything down.
Yeah. I think that's such an important piece. And I spoke to Dr. Alex Ian Taffy and Dr. Meg John Barker on this conference about relational trauma. And one of the things we talked about is like slow relating and why it's so difficult when you have trauma, and at the same time, how helpful it can be. So I think that that thing of noticing how we have a tendency for urgency when we have trauma, and that actually when we notice that tendency, doing our best to find some space and to slow it as much as possible, whilst also recognizing that it can be very challenging to do that. And I'm so glad you brought in the piece around the wheel of consent. I've had the privilege of interviewing Dr. Betty Martin, who created the wheel of consent a couple of times on these different conferences. And so we talked about consent on one of them, and we talked about boundaries on another one. So people should also check out those interviews, which you can all find on the Conscious Life platform. And, you know, it makes sense what you were saying about the need for role models, because like you were saying at the beginning, that unfamiliarity is what creates that kind of alert of like, is this safe? I don't recognize this kind of thing, right? Am I under threat or not? And so there is no resources, or if there are no role models or no representation or no one in your life, then that can really add to that, right? Whereas if you have people where you see it being done, quote unquote, successfully, or you have, you know, representation, and it has to be positive representation as well, whether that's in real life or fiction, then that can be really supportive. And so, you know, and I think, you know, you were talking about peer support, and I think that that's really important. And at the same time, you were saying as well, you know, your family or your friends or your peers may or may not be supportive. But even if they are, if they themselves are not practicing non-monogamy, it doesn't matter how supportive they are, there's going to be certain things they don't get. Or sometimes, you know, if you're struggling with an issue, they're going to say, oh, it's because you're non-monogamous, instead of being like, you know. And so I think whilst you know, whether or not your family and your friends and your coworkers are supportive or not, it's really important to connect with community, to find peers who are going through something similar and or elders that you can, you know, look up to or ask questions to or who can reflect what's going on.
And I think the question of eldership is a really interesting one in the non-monogamy world, because, you know, non-monogamy is not new. This isn't some like recent invention. Non-monogamy has been going on around the world for millennia. I think the expression of it changes through time, and it's going to be culturally different in different parts of the world. It still is that way today. Even, you know, in the more or less hegemony of North America, there's a lot of different subcultures of non-monogamy that exist. And, you know, finding eldership in there that reflects what you are doing can be challenging. Because I think, you know, where we have started to explore in non-monogamy is, you know, non-monogamy has kind of, I think the conversation has shifted along with conversations around feminism and intersectionality and all these other movements to disrupt the status quo and challenge systems of inequity. And so, you know, there are some people who are practicing non-monogamy who are still very patriarchal. And they may not think of themselves as that way, but the way that they are engaging in relationships, maybe the assumptions that they're engaging around gender dynamics, for example, could still be rooted in patriarchy. And so that may not be the best role model for someone who's approaching non-monogamy from more of an anarchist and feminist value system. And I think this is a challenge that we face today is, you know, who are the elders that we can look up to, who are exploring the kinds of relationships that reflect what we are aspiring to. I feel like every queer non-monogamous person I know, myself included, has that dream of the poly-utopia of a piece of land where we all have our own little tiny home, or, you know, we're going to buy a castle in France and like have a little commune. And it sounds very lovely, but, you know, how many people have actually done that before us? And so then you get into the space where like, gosh, there are no elders who've done this. Or if there are elders, where are they? I don't know about them. Or, you know, we discover who they are and then we find out they're imperfect human beings. We can't just put them up on a pedestal. And, you know, I don't think we should ever put anybody on a pedestal. But, you know, it can kind of, it brings in a little bit of despair, I think, for some people. And I noticed that, instead of quote unquote elders in the non-monogamous community, we have people who are leaders, people who are, you know, people who are writing, people who are researching, like you mentioned, Meg John Barker, you know, I think of them as an elder, and I hope that they're not offended by me calling them that, but, you know, the people who are supporting everyone to be able to see their own experience and to feel validated in their experience. And I think that's an incredible resource. And, you know, when people exploring non-monogamy go to like their therapist or their counselor, if that therapist or counselor doesn't have resourcing in non-monogamy, whether they're a non-monogamous or not, you know, if they don't have resourcing, if they can't provide their client with those examples, then, you know, their client's still going to struggle,
yeah,
with the non-monogamy piece. And I feel like there is such a strong need for more non-monogamous resources for conventional therapy.
Absolutely. And, you know, this is where I love the internet, right? Because I think the internet helps people find those role models, find the elders that are doing it in a similar way to them that they wouldn't otherwise have access to. And Martha Kalpe, who I've also interviewed, does some great work. Her best book, or her most well-known book, is Polyamory, a Toolkit for Therapists and Their Clients, right? So it really supports exactly what you were speaking to. And I'm curious because, you know, especially when there aren't role models, it can be easy at times for just like any relationship, but especially non-monogamy sometimes, because there are no templates for it to be toxic. And you and I talked about this on the Heal Toxic Relationship Super Conference. And for and when I say for it to be toxic, I don't mean non-monogamy as a whole. I mean certain behaviors, certain relationships, for there even to be like abuse sometimes, emotional, physical. And again, this isn't only in non-monogamy, but this is what we're talking about today. And we have to acknowledge the reality that it does happen in non-monogamy too. And that, again, when we don't know what the alternatives are, and when it's so unfamiliar, and we, especially if we're in those trauma responses and trying to override our instincts, for example, because it's unfamiliar and we don't know what we're doing, then it's easy to for those, you know, toxic situations to happen. And I myself have experienced those. I've also experienced super healthy non-monogamous relationships, and some of the most beautiful, loving, fulfilling, healthy relationships I've had have been non-monogamous. And some of the most toxic, abusive relationships have been non-monogamous. That's what happens when almost all my relationships have been non-monogamous, right?
Yeah.
And so if someone has experienced trauma in non-monogamy, what does that mean? Like, does that mean that they need to revert back to monogamy, or maybe not even revert back? Does it mean that they should try something else? Like, how do we heal from trauma experience specifically in or from non-monogamous relationships?
I mean, I think for many people, the instinct is to abandon non-monogamy and go back to monogamy. And I think, you know, that's a fair and valid instinct to feel. I also think that, and what I find is that that's not always necessarily the solution, because that can sometimes be like, I'm going to quote unquote heal this by avoiding it. And that takes us back into that place, you know, where we're compartmentalizing stuff. And then what you're left with is what's called an incomplete trauma response, an incomplete self-protective response. And, you know, I've seen people do that. And then what happens if their partner cheats on them? Or what happens if, you know, their monogamous partner is, they think they're flirting with somebody at a party, and they have a reaction to that, right? It, going back to monogamy doesn't make the trauma go away. And I think that we need to honor, you know, if we chose to step into non-monogamy, what were the reasons for it? You know, we want to come back into that and really connect to that authentic part of ourselves. For a lot of people, they go to explore non-monogamy because they don't believe that one person can be everything for them. They don't want to put that pressure on one person, and they don't want that pressure on themselves. And what a lot of people do get to experience through non-monogamy is a really profound level of safety. Because you're not just looking to one person to be your source of secure attachment. You're actually potentially experiencing secure attachment through multiple relationships, right? To me, that's the poly dream. That is the goal of, okay, not just one relationship that has secure attachment in it, but multiple relationships. For some people, that doesn't look like polyamory. That might look more like relationship anarchy. So it may not just be the romantic connections. It could also be the platonic connections that come in. But, you know, there is that potential. And so when that isn't what we experience, when all we experience is disruption, pain, hurt, harm, as you're saying, like the toxic experiences that can come up in that milieu of confusion and disconnection and dissociation, and we retreat away, what we're actually doing often is pulling away from potential resources. Now, I'm not saying you should stay in an abusive situation. Absolutely, do not stay in an abusive situation. But this goes back to, like, don't throw the baby out with the bathwater saying, right? Not all non-monogamy is going to be like that. And I think there are so many resources that have been created by people in the non-monogamous community, whether they're out about being non-monogamous or not, that help us to understand how we can reach out to wider community. Because, you know, when we retreat, when we're in a state of trauma and we retreat, we are often isolating ourselves to protect ourselves. And if we stay in isolation, how do we heal? Healing, there's only so much we can do as an individual. Eventually, to heal rupture and harm that has happened in relationship, we need to experience relationship. And whether that is through the context of monogamy or through the context of relationship anarchy or through the context of non-monogamy or something else, you know, we are eventually going to have to go back into relationship to heal all of those things. And I think if you've experienced rupture in non-monogamy, healing through non-monogamy is possible. It takes slowing down, like you're saying. When we're hurt, we tend to rush through and we want to like rush to the end goal to know that we're safe. But I think slowing down and revisiting things from the perspective of centering ourselves, right? Very often when we have experienced that harm in relationships, we're experiencing some form of disconnection, either as a consequence of that harm or, you know, the disconnection made it so that we didn't notice the harm was happening in the moment. So to come back into connection with yourself and then go back into those experiences, whether that's going into similar experiences or just working through it with, you know, a professional, I think it's important to be able to rewire our nervous system to know it wasn't the whole framework that was unsafe. It was that person and that behavior that was unsafe. Mm-hmm. And that's the sort of thing that I see happen when people abandon non-monogamy, right? They're making this association between it's the non-monogamy that was unsafe, but it was actually the person and their behaviors that was unsafe. Does that make sense?
It does, absolutely. And I would say, yeah, I would focus even more on the behaviors than the person, right? That's one of the things I really learned in the Heal Toxic Relationship Super Conference, is to separate not just the relationship style, but separate also the relationship, the person, the behaviors, all of that, and be like, and then you know what to look out for. Because if you just say, oh, it's the person, then it can be easy to be like, okay, get rid of that person from your life and then fine. But you might start to notice patterns happening again with someone else. And then it's also worth questioning in yourself. If you notice similar patterns happening with different partners, like what's going on for me, right? What are some unhelpful or harmful behaviors that I'm exhibiting? And sometimes they can even be masked as helpful, right? Like I've seen people end up in very toxic relationships on a regular basis because they struggle to say no, because yeah, they're a very caring, loving person who always wants to give and rescue and help the other. So that sounds like, oh, that sounds like a great person. But actually, if they keep ending up in these, so that's why when you recognize the behavior, like the way that person treated me was not okay. And part of, you know, that is saying, therefore, the person who is doing that, especially if you've tried to have a conversation with them, and it doesn't stop, like, yes, definitely get that person out of your life. Definitely, you know, if you need to, but really looking at the behavior as being the traumatic experience, as being the toxic experience, right? So that you don't end up in that pattern again with anyone else. I think it's also really interesting what you were saying about, you know, the different forms that non-monogamy takes. Non-monogamy literally just means not monogamous, right? And you and I have spoken many times about the different forms it can take, so I don't want to go into that again today, but I will say that I found for myself that I was trying to do a very specific form of polyamory that was happened to be the community that I fell into when I first started exploring honest, ethical non-monogamy. And that in the end, after a few years, I realized that that form didn't work for me. And that doesn't make me suddenly monogamous, but it makes me want to explore a different way of doing ethical, honest non-monogamy, right? And I think that that's okay. It's not so much about being so traumatized that you run away from the whole thing and either go back to monogamy or go like, I can't do that. But again, learning about yourself, recognizing that it isn't fixed, that it's okay to be fluid, to explore different ways of doing things until you find something that works for you, where you genuinely feel safe. And that's coming back to the start, where your nervous system feels relaxed.
And what we're talking about here is what we've talked about before in one of the super conferences, is that radical self-relationship, right? How impactful it is to relate to yourself in a loving way. And I want to acknowledge that can be a journey for so many people, right? We may have experienced so much shaming around our own responses, whether that was in childhood or through past relationships. And I know several people who have a hard time sitting with their own discomfort, sitting with what their own responses are, and they kind of go into this like, oh my gosh, what am I doing? And they can start spinning around that. So that's one of those places where our self-relationship can be supported by having the right people around us, whether that is, you know, with loving, caring professionals, loving and caring family, friends, peers, relationship support groups, and so forth. But I think this is why I come back again and again to this idea of a self-relationship. And, you know, I think this idea gets misunderstood. People think like, oh, it's just like, oh yeah, sure, you married yourself, or like people think it's a fad, and or I've heard all sorts of things said about this now, or they think it's like creating an artificial hierarchy. And I'm like, this is about showing up for yourself. Right. And so many of us have been habituated in, I would say, sort of toxic, monogamous, heteronormative behaviors to not show up for ourselves, to show up for what our partner wants instead. And so to turn that around and say, I'm going to choose to show up for myself. And I'm going to choose to have this relationship with myself where I'm in conversation with myself about what I'm experiencing from moment to moment. And if I don't know what I'm experiencing, I'm going to slow down. Just as, you know, if you saw a partner in a state of panic, you might go, hey, let's take a breath. Let's take a moment. Let's pause. If this isn't feeling good, we don't have to do this right now. Right. And to have that level of connection with yourself, that you can have that conversation and notice when those red flags are coming up, either in what you're experiencing around you, or you notice those little indicators you're in yourself that, this is how I react when there's a red flag around.
Mm-hmm.
Right. And I think the more we hone that relationship to ourselves, the better equipped we are to notice, am I safe right now?
Absolutely.
If I'm not safe, or if I don't know that I'm safe, what information might help me to know whether I'm safe or not?
100%.
What is it that I as an individual need in this moment? Because we're all going to have slightly different needs. And, you know, this is applicable to all kinds of relating, right? But I think in non-monogamy, the more we can be clear in that in ourselves, the easier it makes us, the easier it is for us to show up with others with clarity, so that they can know whether, you know, where their safety lies with us.
And I think, you know, it's really important the way you were saying, like, a self-relationship doesn't, or prioritizing your relationship with self, you know, it doesn't mean turning into a hermit and cutting off all relating, right? It's actually the opposite in some ways. And, you know, I spent the majority of this past year in a monogamous relationship with myself. And now I'm dating again, and I see how differently I'm dating, because I really learn to tune into myself, to prioritize my own needs, to put myself first for the first time in my life. And so I really appreciate everything you've brought in. And, you know, we touched upon some of this and more on your solo polyamory conference that you did for Solo Polyamory Day, where you interviewed me and many, many other speakers about their experience, and people can watch that on YouTube. So I'm wondering if you want to say where people can find that, and also how people can find out a bit more about you and your work.
Absolutely. So the main place to go is radicalrelationshipcoaching.ca. That's my main online portal, and you'll find all those things connected and linked in there. You can also find me on social media on Instagram and Facebook at Radical Relating.
Fantastic. Thank you so much for your time today, Mel. It's flown by as always. I wish we had more of it, but I think we've touched upon some really important topics. So thank you.
Thank you so much.